The date is April 10th, 1987, and we're watching The Secret of My Success. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello, and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. I am Sean Wells, and with me is my partner on this journey.
I am Colin Stewart.
I just figured I'd try a little something different with the opening there to
spice things up,
get past the regular host and co-host stigmas and all that sort of thing. So I'm gonna break from our usual routine here, and I just want to point out a couple of corrections from last week with our Police Academy episode. Because normally when I'm editing the show and listening to it, if I've made a mistake in something I've said, I like to go in and add an editing Sean. If you're a longtime listener, you've probably heard the editing Seans before. And last week's episode, I realized that I would have been interrupting every 10, 15 minutes if I had to correct all these in the show. So I just want to point out a couple things. I have since looked up the movie Lavalantula. It is very much like a Sharknado type movie. It was something that was released on the Sci-Fi Network. And a couple things I missed there as well is that it's starring Steve Guttenberg and Leslie Easterbrook as well. So there were a couple other Police Academy connections that I missed. But Colin, you had said that you thought that it would be cooler if the spiders were made out of lava. Looking at the trailer, I watched the trailer for it, and there's an earthquake and there's a crack that forms, and these spiders are born of the lava and they breathe fire.
Nice.
And they spit lava. So,
love it.
So they're not made out of lava from what I can tell in the trailer, but there is definitely...
They spew lava.
They spew lava, so there's definitely a big emphasis on the lava in the movie. So you'll be happy to know that if you want to look up Lavalantula or To Lava, To Lantula, which has way more of the Police Academy cast than I thought in the first place. There was one point in last week's recording that I was talking about, I said the letter R, the letter U, and the letter 4. I just want to let you know that I do know that 4 is a number and not a letter. I also talked a little bit about the stunt shows at the Universal theme parks, and I quoted Indiana Jones as being the stunt show that was at the theme park, and I forgot completely that that was a Disney stunt show. And at Universal in California, the stunt show that's there is actually a Waterworld stunt show. And I remember at one point there being a Backdraft stunt show and things like that as well. But Disney World or Universal, they all have stunt shows, and so I just mixed up what they were. I also looked up that the Warner Brothers Movie World is actually in Australia, not in the US, but I was right about Six Flags Magic Mountain being from California. Also, there was a whole bullet count conversation that we had, and I was talking about the fact that he had blanks and Copeland's guns, and the bullet count didn't match up until he got Mahoney's gun and all that sort of thing. I completely forgot about Lieutenant Harris's gun. So even though it was a ridiculous amount of shots and the guns were still fully loaded when they were handed back, there were more guns in play. But the bullets still don't quite match up because of those two fully loaded guns. I also mentioned that I thought that Mission to Moscow, the seventh Police Academy film, came out in the early 2000s, but it was actually a 1994 film. It was still terrible. And there was also a reference when I was talking about SNL comedies from that time period. And I quoted John Candy as being one of those guys. I know he's not SNL, and I didn't finish my thought at the time in the recording. But John Candy, I just lumped him in with the same kind of people as like Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase and all them, because like he worked with them too. So, but he's a an SCTV guy. So those are my corrections from last week. So a little long-winded, but I just had to get that off my chest because I haven't received any emails yet, but that episode was ripe for emails or tweets correcting me and everything like that. So let's get into our movie for today though. This week, we're looking back at April 1987, when the movies and theaters were Dolls, The Evil Dead 2, Police Academy 4, Citizens on Patrol, so there's a nice segue, Lethal Weapon, and of course, our movie for today, The Secret of My Success, which earned $111 million on a 12-18, there's a little discrepancy there, million-dollar budget.
Maybe they did some reshoots that cost a little bit extra?
Maybe? I'm not sure.
Well, anyways, as always, there will be spoilers, but I mean, this movie is 33 years old, so that should be expected. But if you don't want the movie to be spoiled for you, then please press pause, go watch it, and then come back and hear what we have to say.
Okay, so the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "There's no such thing as an overnight success. Brantley Foster took 2 weeks." So, good summary, but that may not be the best description, so let's go to Colin for a 60-second synopsis.
Alright, this week's 60-second synopsis, I cannot claim is my own writing. I have borrowed it from a journalist in Chicago named Katie Sullivan, who writes for the Chicago Sun-Times. And basically, okay. I came across this in my travels and my research, and I felt like her synopsis perfectly captures how I felt about this movie. So here it goes.
Fair enough. Okay.
The 1987 Universal movie, The Secret of My Success, is a dumpster fire. Despite starring the undeniably endearing Michael J. Fox, the plot is a primer in Entitlement 101. Brantley, played by Fox, is a young guy from Kansas who gets mad because he isn't handed his dream job when he arrives in New York City. He soon lies and cons his way into an executive office while constantly ogling and or sexually harassing Prescott Industries' sole female executive, Christy, played by Helen Slater. Brantley gets the girl and saves the company with his underhanded ways. And that is your 60-second synopsis.
Thank you, Katie. Was it Katie, did you say?
Yeah, Katie, yep. Sullivan, Chicago Sun-Times.
Thank you, Katie Sullivan. Yeah, when I was younger, I loved this movie. It was one of those ones. I love Michael J. Fox. And so it was because of movies like Back to the Future and, well, I guess pretty much Back to the Future. But
were you a Spin City fan in
that? Well, yeah, but that was later on. I mean, yeah. I remember this movie from when it first came out. I was too young to understand anything that was actually going on in this movie. But I knew Back to the Future and Family Ties. But, oh, and Teen Wolf. There's the other Michael J. Fox that I used to love. And so, for me, it's Michael J. Fox doing some of his bumbling things that he does so well. But it is very much, I used to love this movie. Like, I've noticed a lot of different perspectives of this movie now that I'm an adult. But that's me. What about you, Colin? What's your experience with Secret of My Success?
I had no experience with this movie. I'd never even heard of it before. Unlike you, I'm not going to say I'm not a Michael J. Fox fan. It's just that I have no, like, attachment to him whatsoever. Like, I never watched any of his TV shows. I'd never even really watched any of his movies. Like, to put it into context, I only watched Back to the Future for the first time 2 years ago.
Wow.
Okay. And I've only seen the first one. I haven't even seen the entire trilogy. And that's probably literally the only other Michael J. Fox movie I've ever watched.
Okay.
I think the only other times I've seen him were maybe some cameos on some TV shows.
Well, you brought up Spin City. Were you a Spin City watcher at all?
So I wasn't. I didn't watch it religiously. But okay. It was one of those shows that I would kind of like turn on every now and then if it was on. And
if it was on, you wouldn't turn it off.
Yeah,
exactly. Okay, yeah.
So yeah, I don't really have that affinity for Michael J. Fox Not that I think he's a bad actor or anything. I just really haven't watched much of his stuff. Never heard of this movie before.
We have to have that kinship to famous Canadian actors, though.
Yeah. And I think that is one of the things. It's like, I just know him as that Canadian actor.
He's a Canadian icon. Canadian actor. Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, so Secret of My Success, directed by Herbert Ross. His directing credits go all the way back to 1969 with Goodbye, Mr. Chips. He directed My Blue Heaven, Steel Magnolias, and he directed Footloose. Which, the fact that he directed Footloose might show the reason for so many musical moments in this movie.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, that just hit me just now as I'm reading back my notes. It's produced by David Chasman. His only two other credits are The Brighton Beach Memoirs and Murder on Flight 502. And it's written by Jim Cash, who has 9 total credits. Here's all of them. Top Gun, Legal Eagles, Turner and Hooch, Dick Tracy, Anaconda, Anaconda's Trail of Blood, and Flintstones in Viva Rock Vegas.
Nice.
So, a little bit of everything. Also written by Jack Epps Jr., who has identical credits plus a couple of others, and A.J. Carruthers, who has 27 total credits and mostly TV. This was his last screenwriting credit. We open on the very 80s David Foster song, The Secret of My Success, and are instantly thrown into a montage to kick things off. It's definitely not a traditional, like, all-music montage, but this is the one that sets up the entire story. We see glimpses of New York City and all the weirdness and all the fashion and all the ladies.
And all the diversity.
Yeah, all the diversity, which we don't see any other time in the movie. And powerful business things there, intercut with the simplicity of life in Kansas, with a couple farmers talking about New York City, even though he's never been there. And the farmer are the parents of Brantley Foster, the wonderful Michael J. Fox, the Canadian icon Michael J. Fox from Back to the Future, The Frighteners, Doc Hollywood, Family Ties, Spin City, and a special connection to us on this show because his birthday is June 9th, 1961. His place of birth, Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, where we are recording from. So there we go. We have an extra kinship to him on this show. We see Brantley arrive in New York City on the bus and, of course, drops the line. Well, Toto, I guess we're not in Kansas anymore.
I just wanted to point out, you always talk about how, like, you hate seeing how bad people are playing video games and movies. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to point out how bad Brantley Foster is at being a farmer. Like, they have that one scene in the montage where he's
shirtless with the pitchfork,
shoveling hay, yeah, but his hair is perfectly coiffed. He's not dirty.
No dirt.
In any way. Yep. He's not sweating. Having grown up on a farm, I was like, they did this last minute, I think.
Yeah, they did this in between boardroom scenes. They just filled up a room with hay and had him shovel some of it around. So he arrives at his new home in New York. It's a shitty studio apartment that hasn't been cleaned out from the last tenant.
I know, it literally looks like a hoarder lives in there.
Yeah, like this wasn't stuff that was brought by a moving truck and dropped off or anything, right?
Like, it looks like a storage unit. It doesn't even look like it doesn't look like somebody lived there at
all. It's just piles of boxes and crap. I hope he got a discount for that. Yeah, at least didn't have to put in the security deposit or something. He makes a deal with the rodents and the bugs in the place to stay on their side of the room, and he'll stay on his. And we get that Michael J. Fox wit, that boyish charm. He reports for his first day of work, only to promptly get fired because the company he was hired by has just become the victim of a hostile takeover. So now he's unemployed and out to find a new job, and we get a series of brief scenes, and basically they all show this vicious circle that he's stuck in of needing more experience to get a job, but unable to get a job because he has no experience, and college experience isn't real experience. It's kind of like the idiot loop from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure about Eddie Van Halen, R.I.P. Eddie Van Halen. It's basically he's become Alex P. Keaton the next chapter, if Alex P. Keaton had been raised on a farm. he tells one of the interviews that he can be anything she wants. I can be taller, I can be skinnier, or whatever. And she said, can you be a minority woman? So at least they're... at least this person is hiring for diversity.
There is that, but the fact that that's like a joke... Part of the problem with his... Going back to that synopsis we read earlier, but it's just like... I really struggled to get into this movie and find any sympathy for Brantley.
Yeah.
But I think it's because of the world we live in now. But I'm just like, yeah... You're a white dude. Like, how hard do you think it was for a black guy in that? Like, if Brantley was black, he would just be homeless.
And this woman right here, I mean, yeah, she's not even looking for a minority man. She's looking for a minority woman. So, like, the black man definitely would be left out of this movie. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of that with this movie. And, I mean, there's also the fact that Brantley is, like, straight up a criminal.
Yeah.
Right? Like you know, I'll get more into it at some point. It's in my notes later on. But already he's showing his crime streak. Because he goes to the first interview, and the guy says, you only have college experience, not real experience. And then he goes to this interview with the HR woman at the other company, and she is reading off the things on his resume, and it's like, you know... district manager of some sort of furniture. Like, did he fudge his resume? Like, yeah. are those legit credits on his resume?
I think we should talk about this more, like, at the end, after, because I do have, like, a lot of thoughts. Okay. Just about, like, yeah, just Brantley is not a good guy.
He's not. Okay, so he phones home. He's on a payphone to lie to his parents about how great everything is, as he witnesses an armed robbery and a shootout with the cops. He continues lying to his mom, saying that the noise she's hearing is Miami Vice, and the volume knob broke off in his hand. His mom asks if he's phoned Uncle Howard, who has a very vague connection to him. It was something about a cousin, husband of a second cousin or some shit.
All you need to know is that kin is kin.
Kin is kin. That's how you sum it up. Exactly. So we get a flashback now of him talking to his mom on the phone in another, like, mini montage here. And he's talking to his mom on the about how he doesn't want handouts and he wants to succeed on his own terms, and how he refuses the round trip plane ticket his parents give him because next time he comes home, it'll be in a private jet. And this montage too starts with flashbacks of the plane ticket, and it blends into the going to see Uncle Howard montage, where it's businessmen and a couple of business women.
I'm gonna say, so they have that scene that shows them, like, this, like, massive horde of people walking through these towers, crossing the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
So I pause that scene, and I just want to say, there's one Asian guy at the front. You can see a black guy's forehead. But then as far as you can see past, no diversity.
Yeah, and there's, like, I know at one point there's a single woman coming up an escalator who, I mean, she was probably one of the secretaries, quite frankly. Yeah, all that diversity that they showed in the beginning of the people turning to face the camera in that first montage, they're all gone here in these other ones. We get more establishing shots of the city, and Brantley arrives at the Pemrose Corporation without an appointment to see his uncle. He's currently in a meeting, but we can hear him yelling from the reception area. Brantley saying stuff like, seems like a nice guy, and who doesn't love surprises? Brantley uses the conveniently placed photocopier, like, why isn't this in a copy room, to copy his face to make a whimsical business card for the receptionist to give to his uncle. The meeting lets out, and as we've seen with the diversity count, one of the executives is black, and one of them is a woman. Except I don't think the woman was even in this particular yelling match. I don't remember her being in that scene. But the receptionist goes in, she gets yelled at for a bit about not knowing a nephew, and then Mr. Prescott will see you now. So he talks to his uncle, who is played by Richard Jordan. Has 55 credits going back to 1962. He was in Dune, Hunt for Red October, Gettysburg, and Posse were his last two films. He's mildly surprising him with his knowledge of the business. Everything from dog food to guided missile systems. and he swallows his pride to ask his uncle for a job. He sends him to personnel. You're in the front door, kid. What you do on this side of it is up to you. So next we see Brantley in the lobby of the building drinking from the water fountain, and his drink is interrupted by Christy Wills. And Christy Wills is played by Helen Slater, who is in Ruthless People, City Slickers, best known as Supergirl in the Supergirl movie, and of course appears in anything DC then because of it. So like, she guest starred on Smallville, she was in the Supergirl series, she's Supergirl's mom, and she played Martha Kent in the cartoon DC Superhero Girls. And so Christy wants a drink from the fountain, and so we get a pseudo montage.
Like, what the fuck was up with that? It happens twice. This close-up shot to her lips, the water hitting her lips. I did not understand what was going on.
Yeah, he's watching her in slow motion drink from the fountain. And like, swallows in a way that makes you think that
she just took a big gulp.
And then it turns into her in this sexy dress walking across the lobby all and alone,
spinning around in the turnstile door.
So
until she disappears.
This is where those Footloose directing notes come in, I guess.
Also the stereotypical like 80s. Saxophone. I don't even know it.
Like
saxophone love music,
and almost like synthesizer saxophone. I don't even know if it was real saxophone.
I wanted to point out that, well, my wife pointed this out when we watched it, but there's a weird thing in the 80s. Like, Michael J. Fox forever just looks 14.
Yeah,
like he looks like a child, even though he was 26 years old, I think, when this movie came out.
Yeah,
and then.
Well, and he says in it at one point that he's 24.
Yeah.
And I know I looked at him and went, what?
Yeah.
Really? You still look like you can play the high school kid from Back to the Future.
I was going to say, he's like 2 years removed from Teen Wolf.
Yeah.
So, but then, what's her name?
Christy Wills.
So she looks like 35.
Yeah.
She looks so old.
Mm-hmm. I almost think of the Christy Wills' look. I've always thought of Happy Gilmore, because in that one Adam Sandler is such a baby, and he looks so young compared to the PR person that he falls in love with there. And I mean, now with she's on what's her name? Oh my, Julie Bowen.
Yeah,
she looks so much different on Modern Family, or if you've recently seen the Netflix movie Hubie Halloween.
Yeah.
Which is all fan service for anyone that likes Happy Madison Productions. I always thought the same thing with Happy Gilmore, though, is that this woman seems so much more glamorous and older than the protagonist in the movie.
It's just complete. But, it's just one of those things, like, it's completely different now.
Yeah.
Because now, like, the women always look, like, way younger.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you have an older woman, she's, like, she plays the cougar role.
Yeah, she's Stifler's mom. So the next day is Brantley's first day in the mailroom. He shows up wearing a suit, dressed for the job you want, I guess. He meets God, a.k.a. Barney Rattigan, but all my notes I refer to him as God. So Barney, but I'll be calling him God because I love it. He's played by Christopher Murney. He has 42 credits. Barton Fink, Last Exit to Brooklyn, Maximum Overdrive were some of his big ones. God tells him to lose the tie. And he gets Fred Melrose to show him the ropes. And Fred Melrose is played by John Pankow, who has 51 credits. He was in the TV series Episodes, which was a Matt LeBlanc show. To Live and Die in L.A., Cousin Ira on Mad About You is probably what he's most famous for. Brantley's training, however, involves very little other than Fred pointing out the class differences between them and the suits. Never consort with the suits seems to be Fred's mantra. Brantley gets to see business as basically an invisible man, and he gets to watch things, you know, like recently laid off employees who he is going to identity thief later on. Brantley is just too curious because he's doing his mailroom job and he keeps reading the memos that are coming past him, even at times opening envelopes. Like, there has to be some sort of crime being committed here.
Well, yeah, because it's more than memos. It's if you're opening an envelope, I assume it's mail.
Yeah.
Like, memos are usually just a sheet.
Yeah, and he's not even reading them all at work because he starts taking the files out of the building on his lunch breaks. So there's got to be a law that he's breaking here.
The thing that drives me nuts about watching stuff like that, like a lot of Brantley's, even his like speech that he gives his uncle to get the job,
yeah,
is like, I just bet you there were people in the 1980s who are watching this movie like, yeah, that's what I need to do to get it. That's what you need to do to get ahead. Like, you just
that's the one right there. That's the speech.
This movie would be a form of like professional development training for some people, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is what not to do. Like, I think a lot of this could appear in sexual harassment videos at time too.
Yes.
Reading all these memos, Brantley is finding holes in the way that the company runs. Now it's time for the get a learning the company montage here, where he's reading and photocopying and lightly stalking Christy Wills, and Fred tells him she's a Rolls Royce, but still a suit. He's all about the suits. He's all about the class. And this montage even includes flashbacks to the previous montage, where it's the slow motion drinking from the water fountain and stuff like that.
Oh my gosh.
So one day at work, Brantley is recruited to drive one of the suits' wives home. In the limo, we meet Vera Prescott, who is played by Margaret Witten, who was in Major League. She was a piece of meat in that one as well. Little Monsters, 9½ Weeks, who is, of course, above the kind of taxi driver banter that Brantley wants to provide. He offers to help her because she looks upset. We find out she's stressed for a bunch of reasons, such as her cook quitting and her husband screwing around with someone else. She asks what he had in mind, to which he responds, I don't know, stick a gum? But with that, we go to Sponsorship Corner! This is another one that isn't too big. Secret of My Success is brought to you by Double Mint Gum, Kodak, Chase Bank, Wet Paint Brand Paint. There were a lot of spray paint cans that were Wet Paint Brand Paint. I don't know why everybody was painting so much, but you never actually see them use any of this paint. Lincoln, Wonder Bread, and Molson Beer. But it wasn't Molson Canadian. It was like those gold cans. So good for you, Michael J. Fox, drinking Canadian beer. Plus the book Take Over Madness by Alan Michel and Israel Shaked. It might be like Shaked. Is prominently displayed on Christie's desk at one point. And this has been Sponsorship Corner. So Vera is talking on the car phone, and Brantley is kind of eavesdropping. When she gets off the phone, he ends up complimenting her by saying that her husband is a fool for cheating. Well, apparently this is fucking catnip to Vera, because now we get another pseudo-montage with the song Oh Yeah playing, which seems to be a metaphorical sex scene that's happening right now. Not an actual sex scene, but there's antennas going up and windshield washer fluid spraying. And it all ends with a cigarette at the end. Like, it's like they're acting out sex with this car. It's funny because at one point, it was actually during this, because the song Oh Yeah gets used later on in another montage. And my son came into the room when I was watching that scene. And he goes, isn't this the song that's made famous by Ferris Bueller? Yeah. Like, he asked me, when did Ferris Bueller come out? And I'm like, I never thought of that. So Ferris Bueller came out in 1986. So Ferris Bueller uses this song, and then this movie tries to copy it, because I guess it's the same sort of movie, because it's, you know, a carefree guy that's breaking all the rules. Yeah. So we're now at Vera's house, and Brantley helps her with her bags into the house. and she aggressively comes on to him, gives him drinks, and basically abducts him for the afternoon, and they take a dip in the pool, and she...
Rapes him.
Yep. I was going to use the word aggressively again here. She aggressively assaults him in the pool by taking off his shorts, which isn't very well choreographed, I have to say. Much like Sylvester Stallone in Demolition Man, I made sure that I was doing a little dunk check. And
you can clearly see he's wearing the nude tights.
Yes, yes, absolutely. He's definitely wearing something under those boxers that she pulls off. And yeah, she straight up assaults him.
I mean, for the record, in the pool, she is not wearing nude tights over her chest.
Yes, yes, but it...
My wife pointed that out, so don't call me a pervert or anything. Yeah. I didn't see the nipple, but she made sure that I did.
You have to be really quick on the pause button to get those ones. That's right. And I remember that from when I was a kid, too.
Just blurry.
So... clearly they fuck because they're lying around in bathrobes afterwards, and they're chatting, and Brantley is busy calling her husband a jerk, and her husband comes home, doing one of the things that I absolutely hate in movies and television, is they come home honking the horn. Have you ever pulled into your driveway and beep, beep, beep to make sure everyone knows that they're that you're there? I remember I had the kind of parents that even when I picked up girls on dates when I was 16 in my car, I was supposed to go to the door. I wasn't supposed to pull into the driveway and honk. I don't understand why he announces his arrival.
I mean, it might be a good thing to do if you suspect your wife is having an affair, but you don't really care.
Yeah.
Just for like a 3-minute warning.
As he says, they have an understanding at one point. The husband, though, of course, that has just honked pulling in is Uncle Howard! He just fucked Auntie Vera! Oh no! What a catastrophe! And the hijinks begin. So he scrambles to get dressed and runs and gets chased by a Doberman.
I was trying to remember if they explain exactly how... like, what if Uncle Howard is, like, really the in-law in this situation and Brantley just actually fucked one of his relatives?
He fucked the blood aunt. Oh, I don't know.
I mean, if there's, like, maybe they're fourth cousins, so it's not so bad, but still.
Yeah. The next day, while walking to the office, Fred asks where Brantley disappeared the day before, and Brantley regales him with the tale of being chased by a Doberman, which he says is the best thing that happened to him. Fred asks, what's the worst? Brantley says, I got laid. He says, you have your priorities messed up, Brantley. So I really did like Fred Melrose. Like, you know, give the movie the hard time. I like the delivery of some of Michael J. Fox's lines. And I definitely really like Fred Melrose as a character. He's got some funny things to say, even though he says, don't consort with the suits way too many times.
Yeah, I feel like later on I would have liked a little bit more of, like, Fred, like, being on the heels of Brantley and trying to figure out that what he's doing.
Yeah, like instead of the people that are just trying to catch him for bad reasons, have someone that's just trying to catch him to see what he's up to.
Yeah, I feel like that would have increased the stakes a little bit more.
Yeah, just have one more set of eyes that's keeping an eye on him. So, in the course of his job that day... Brantley comes to the now empty office of the guy that was laid off earlier, and he goes into the office to look around, imagining what his life would be like, and we get another mini montage here. This one is the introspective montage, featuring voiceovers from previous scenes and more cutbacks to previous scenes where he's telling his Auntie Vera that he wants to get to the top of his own, he doesn't want to lag up. He's woken from his daydream by a ringing phone, and in an impulsive moment decides to answer it, and he imitates the executive and starts conducting business, so his life of crime begins. We get a scene with Howard on the roof jogging with his executives and talking about how the stock is dropping. They're worried about a hostile takeover because someone is buying up stock and they need to cut costs. And so the next day, Brantley has gotten this brilliant idea that he's going to start posing as an executive by the name of Carlton Whitfield. He panics because his uncle is nearby and he hides in the nearest office, which happens to belong to Christy Wills. He finally gets to chat with her and it doesn't go well. He makes his way to his commandeered office after his uncle walks by the window and he starts setting up his dual life. So he gets a secretary and uses his mailroom connection who will send a boy from the mailroom with the memo, with the requisition forms that they need. So, like, he's just absolutely full of scams. He gets personalized stationery and a name on the door the same way. So I'm not sure what crime he's committing here, but like
fraud.
Okay, like it would be fraud. It would be identity theft. It would be like.
Well, has he stolen? Has he just made up the name, or did he?
I'm assuming that the guy that got fired was named Carlton Whitfield. Because the guy that phones him from the distribution center, the one that actually starts Brantley's life of crime here, he's the one that says, you know, like, Whitfield, I've been trying to get a hold of you or something like that. Like, I think he has to pose as this guy because this guy's already got established clients.
Plot hole, because that guy was fired. So wouldn't people know that he was fired?
I guess, well...
Like, why would he use his name if everybody else knows it?
That's true, because later on, yeah...
He needs the personalized stationery. If he had taken over someone's identity, wouldn't the stationery...
Or wouldn't the name have already been on the door as well?
And the name would have already been on the door.
And Howard says at one point, I never hired any Carlton Whitfield. So. I don't know which way it goes then. I'd have to go back and watch it again, I guess. But this though is the fundamental flaw to the movie is how is he cashing his paychecks?
Yeah, I thought about that too. I was like, he must just not be getting paid to be an executive.
So he's living on his mailroom salary.
Yeah. But the other thing is he also works in the mailroom, and I'm assuming it seems like they go throughout the office delivering memos.
Yeah.
So like feasibly, would he not eventually, like, I guess he would know, so he could just avoid giving a memo to his own secretary, but he's also the lowest on the totem pole, so there's the potential that he could be ordered to go do this.
Yeah.
But it never happened, so I guess we're all right, but...
he's a criminal. Does he have fake IDs? Like, it's just... he's a criminal! Maybe that's what all that spray paint was for. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, he's now posing as Carlton Whitfield, but he is still doing his job in the mailroom. He gets downstairs and God is angry because he didn't punch in. Like, he thought that he was late, but it turns out that he was actually just posing as an executive, but he got all his work done because thankfully, as Fred says earlier, it takes him about half an hour to do the work. But the boss thinks it takes him 2 hours. So God gives him an envelope and says, run this memo upstairs and wait for an answer. So this is a perfect time for him to change back into his suit and conduct some business. So while he's changing, his new secretary, Jean, arrives. And Jean is played by Carol Ann Susie, who was in My Blue Heaven, Outrageous Fortune, bunch of TV. Most famously... You probably know her from a role where you never saw her face. She was Mrs. Wallowitz on The Big Bang Theory. Oh. Shrieking at Howard from the other room. Yeah, you never saw her, but yeah, that's the one.
Nice.
So Jean is taken aback by her new almost naked boss. So this has to be sexual harassment. Unintentional. I guess he could have locked the door. Maybe if there was a lock on the door. He needs to get a lock for the door either way. It's been a few minutes, so I guess it's time for another montage. So we get the Walking on Sunshine good morning montage of him conducting business and trying to blend in with the suits, but he doesn't fully blend in because his suit is a lighter color than everyone else's. Did you notice that? He's the only one wearing like grayish brown, and everyone else is wearing like navy or black.
Everyone else is also like 50 plus.
Yeah.
Well, he's, like we said, looks 14.
Yeah. he chats up Christy Wills a bit. This one goes a little bit better, but because he's trying to cut through her frosty exterior. And while they're chatting, an emergency meeting is called. And this adds more confusion to that question we had earlier about identity theft. Is the one guy asked him, "Who are you?" And he says, Carlton Whitfield, new employee. He says, "I didn't get a memo." "Oh, you will." So he's using his clever mailroom connections again to make sure that his ruse is completely airtight. But this guy doesn't know who Carlton Whitfield is either. So I guess it's a made-up name. I don't know. I see, you should have gone for Bradley Foster. Fix that Brantley nonsense and do something that... You know, like, you can at least go to a bank and say, because this is before direct deposit too. That's the other fundamental flaw is, yeah, he could go to the bank and be like, they spelled my name wrong. Brantley's hard for them to spell or something.
Or do the inverse and go Foster Brantley.
Yeah, there you go. But his uncle might catch on to that one. Might.
Yeah.
So we find out in the meeting that Donald Davenport is in fact planning a hostile takeover, like Uncle Howard was afraid of on the roof earlier. Everyone wants to slash things, but Brantley has some wild ideas on how to fix things by being bold and building the company. Mr. Prescott's word stands, though, at the end of this. Even though he has amazing business sense, Mr. Prescott, nope, we are going to cut things. So we get another mailroom scene where God asks where Brantley's been, and he says, "You told me to wait for an answer." They're really slow up there. So he keeps his alibi intact, but his boss starts to suspect that something fishy is going on, and he's going to be on Brantley like a rash from now on. At home in his shitty apartment, Brantley acts like a conductor for the music of his neighbors having sex. This is a scene that I definitely remember from when I was a kid that I didn't quite understand what was going on, but it was hilarious to me.
I will say that the like popping the beer can
at the end
is a nice touch.
It's kind of like when he set off the windshield wipers in the limo. Mm-hmm. But while he's in his apartment, Auntie Vera ends up coming over for a booty call. And she says that Uncle Howard is working late, but working late is actually code for out with his mistress, who happens to be, shocker, Christy Wills, the only woman executive. He's not fucking his secretary, he's going after one of the executives. And during the dinner, we see Howard and Christy, and during their dinner, after his aggressive advances keep getting turned down... A lot of aggressive in this movie. That word keeps coming up in my notes.
There's one part where he straight up says to her, I wish I could remember the line verbatim, but he basically says, "I love you." Mm-hmm. And she's like, "No, you don't." And then he's like, "Well, I lust for you at the very least."
Yeah. And I was like, "That's right, yeah. What?" Yeah. That may not be verbatim, but that's close. And it was, wow. This is... When people say, you know, during Me Too that, like, this is something that happened 35 years ago, this is what happened 35 years ago. Like, they have a valid point for their complaints even after this amount of time has passed.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because he is very hard coming on to her. And at first, like, I didn't think that she actually was a mistress. I thought this was some sort of plan. Like, I forgot. I was too young to understand the movie when I saw it early, you know, when I was a kid. But, yeah, I didn't know that he actually was dating her in some capacity. And so this comes up and I thought, oh my God, like he's just straight up, because it turns right to business afterwards. Like, well, it's not until a scene later that we find out that they were actually more intimate, or that it's clearer that they...
Yeah. I was going to say, like, she is also and this kind of like ruins her as a character for me a little bit, but she is also unapologetically just one of these women who is sleeping her way to the top.
Yeah.
Like that comes up.
In their argument at the end. Yeah.
Like, she just wants to move to business. Mm-hmm. And like, he, obviously he's in lust with her, but, like, she clearly just is doing this because she also wants to move up in the company.
And, well, and she's so frosty in that introduction to Brantley when he hides in her office, because he makes the, oh, isn't this the men's room joke? And she, no, they took all the urinals out of here last week. I'm sorry. Being the only women surrounded by men. Like, she's got this frosty, but this very driven personality in that scene where she's not taking Brantley's shit. And then she is kind of just sleeping her way to the top in a way, even if it's unintentionally. Even if that's not how she actually looked at it going into the relationship, it's a bonus side effect. Yeah. And you should have known that if you're going to agree to his advances. But the conversation that they're having after Howard lusting after her ends up turning to the new guy, Carlton Whitfield, because it turns to business. And Howard is concerned that Carlton Whitfield might be a plant from Davenport. So, again, we have this situation of, how do you not know who's being hired in your company then? Like, if you don't recognize the name, and there's no mention that he doesn't even know who Carlton, or I think he does say, I don't know who that is. But, like, how do you not know that for everything that Brantley is doing that's illegal, there's someone that is just too stupid to understand what's being done right under their nose.
Yeah. Also in that scene, I don't know, this is just me, there's a really interesting directorial choice in the way that scene is filmed via the mirror.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was so off-putting to me, because she comes around and is sitting on the bench, so you see her in the frame, but you see him speaking to her via the mirror.
Yeah.
I don't know, there was something about watching it where
unsettling, yeah. And I think you just kind of nailed why I got that unsettling feeling, but it didn't really hit me of why. But I think that might be the reason why.
Yeah.
But because Carlton Whitfield might be a spy for Davenport, now we also set Christy on the case to spy for Howard on Carlton Whitfield. So now we've got, like, this this double agent spy storyline happening to this woman that it's not part of her job description. The only reason she was recruited is because she's fucking him. Like,
yeah.
Oh boy. Okay, so next day at work, we see that Brantley has finally figured out how to be Clark Kent and Superman. He's figured out a better way to conceal his double life. Things like changing in the elevator with socks under socks, and his tie as a headband. Being someone that's done enough theater productions, I know what it's like to have to do a quick change. So believe me, I've done stuff like this where I have a different pair of socks on top of a certain pair of socks. So I know all about these little shortcuts, but I can't imagine walking around all day. That's something where it's like, you know, I have to wait 15 minutes into the show to be able to change. But I can't imagine walking around all day with two sets of clothing on.
Especially when one of them is a suit.
Yeah.
Back in the day, probably one of those, like, kind of woolly suits that would just be super hot.
Yeah. And I like the tie twisted into a headband around his head.
Yeah.
And then he pulls it down, but it's wrinkle-free. It's a good thing Mom sent him with that iron. To do this double life, he's doing things like changing in the elevator, and hijinks ensues because he keeps getting caught. Because he puts on the alarm, but because the elevator repairman was already there to check on the alarm, he manages to get the elevator going again, and so he's just flexing in the elevator wearing just a tie. Gives his clothes to his secretary to get dry clean. Oh boy. You need to come up with better stories, at least, Brantley. So Christy has completed her spy mission by stealing a file from Brantley's office, and we get another board meeting about cuts, and Mr. Prescott surprises them during this meeting, and Brantley has to fake a nosebleed to get out of there so that Uncle Howard doesn't see him in the meeting. Later that night, workaholic Brantley is still working, and Christy the workaholic swings by, and he tries to convince her of his plan for expansion being the better idea than cutting. And she ends up having low blood sugar. I've never known someone that in tune with the levels of their blood sugar that they would use blood sugar as the excuse instead of just saying, I need something to eat because, like, I'm feeling faint here. But she goes right to blood sugar. So she has low blood sugar, so they decide to go get food instead. And we get, like, the best scene in the movie here, which is Sheila the waitress, who is played by Mercedes Rule. It's kind of just a cameo, but I love her scene because she's just butting in and she's throwing in her two cents about business. Oh, yeah, no, expansion is a great idea. And the whole, she's just there to tell them that they look cute together and stuff like that. Brantley says, I think Sheila's right. And she said that we'd look cute together. And Christy says, I think Sheila's an idiot or something like that. And we hear from the distance, I heard that! So this dinner turns into Christy has been kind of convinced that it is a good idea. And it turns into an all-night hangout. And Brantley getting all sentimental about the day that he uses his ticket is the day New York has beaten me. And that's why he refuses to use it. And they end up kissing. And then, of course, they end up fucking. Because you can't just kiss on a first date.
Is this the kiss they have? Or no, is that where they're like on the pier?
They're on a boat, on yeah, a boat. Or okay. something. Like a boat okay. that they snuck onto. Okay, so let's okay. add trespassing okay. to his police charges.
But also, like... The acting choices for this kiss, I don't know what you were thinking. Like, there's nose rubbing and this weird, like, oh, I missed you. And then it's like, is this, I don't know. It's one of the most bizarre on-screen kisses I've probably ever seen in my life.
Yeah, and then it gets even more bizarre, I'd have to say, because they get on the ferry for kiss number two. And this is where we get the cheesy line of, can you do it again? Or can you do it again? But just as good, right? Like it's and then Brantley says, I'll do it better, or something like that. And
again, the entire situation
awkward.
And the entire situation is not made any better by the fact that Michael J. Fox looks like he's a 14-year-old boy. It's just so...
It looks very much like... It looks very much like a high school teacher and student situation. That's what it looks like here. Yeah. This is child rape. So Monday morning, Christy dumps Howard. Yes! I am woman, hear me roar. And Howard tells her that he is filing for divorce to try to get her back. So he's pleading with her to come back. But the conversation turns to business. So we always have these two extremes where it's like, it's very, very personal. And then it turns to business, like just absolute 180 on a dime. But yeah, the conversation has turned to business because Davenport has called an emergency meeting of his own. So Howard is planning to have this party at his home for the executives and a whole bunch of his rich friends and business friends. Maybe I missed the reason for this party entirely.
I'm not sure what it specifically was for.
Yeah, and because the executives also just end up like in a meeting for the entire party. So it's like, oh, hey, thanks for the bonus work day out at your house. Like the bonus work day with nicer scenery. Okay, I think it's time to take a break. I think we need to do a little show and tell.
Excellent. I was hoping you would say this.
Okay. So I know you said you found a couple of things. I didn't find anything exciting. I found on, you know, redbubble.com. Come on, Redbubble, sponsor us. I found a couple of like Michael J. Fox things. Very few things that were specifically Secret to My Success, So I'm going to go serious with my show and tell. And I think that everyone should go to michaeljfox.org and donate to the Michael J. Fox Parkinson Foundation, because it is a terrible disease. And so that is going to be my show and tell. I'm just going to go straight out, you know, I not dive deep, something everybody knows. And I go to michaeljfox.org and support the Parkinson Foundation. And you can also watch a video there of him trying on self-lacing shoes from... You go to
self-lacing.
Yeah, like, oh, you said you haven't seen Back to the Future Part 2. Okay, so the shoes that he wears in Back to the Future Part 2, Nike made an actual, like, prototype of them.
Okay.
And so there are videos from the Michael J. Fox Foundation that I have watched of him trying on these prototypes. And, you know, it's kind of good for considering where he is now with Parkinson's and the Parkinson's Foundation. It's nice that Nike has provided him with shoes that lace on their own. There's my first joke on shaky Michael Fox, but no, go donate to his foundation. So, okay.
Very nice.
That's my show and tell. What about you?
All right. I was very excited to find this show and tell. I don't want to give it away, so I'm not going to explain why. I'm just going to tell you what it is.
Okay.
All right, so earlier this year, in a little suburb of Chicago called Aurora in Illinois...
Home of Bill Wayne and Garth!
Okay, sure.
Wayne's World, man!
The Paramount Theater
presented
the world premiere of The Secret of My Success musical. A Broadway production. So the show was directed by Gordon Greenberg, who previously directed the musical Holiday Inn. Greenberg also co-wrote the book for the musical with Steve Rosen, who has appeared in Broadway productions of Guys and Dolls and Spamalot. And the score was done by Chicago writers Michael Mahler and Alan Schmuckler.
Oh, so they couldn't even get David Foster to help contribute to it, huh?
No.
You might get to it, but is this you said Chicago. Is this like an off Broadway production? Like, do you think this is like legitimately supported by?
From what I gather, the theater is like, it's obviously it's not in New York, but the theater is like, I don't know, part of like their playbill was on like the playbill site. Like, so it's like Broadway affiliated, I guess.
Yeah. So
might be the best way to put it.
Yeah, it would be one of the places where they launch like a preview of it. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering though, like, you know, Beetlejuice the musical and Legally Blonde the musical and all these other musicals that are based on movies, like, they're officially sanctioned. So I'm just wondering, is this, you know, whether it's something where it's like the Harry Potter musical that Starkid did, if you've ever seen those online, those aren't approved.
This is an approved one.
Okay, sorry. So, I'll stop interrupting.
Continuing on, following the same plot as the 1987 film. The cast is led by Billy Harrigan Teague as Brantley and Carlton, Melody A. Betts as Rose Lockhart, Sidney Morton as Christy Lockhart.
Who?
Yeah. Kai Edger as Ernie Lockhart, Jeremy Peter Johnson as Pierce Johnson, Heidi Kettering as Vera Prescott, Barbara Robertson as Joanne Foster, Gabriel Ruiz as Lester Mann, Sarah Savigny as Sylvia Popkin, and Ian Michael Stewart as Garth Portnoy. So there's definitely some name changes. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure which ones are, because I couldn't find the like official playbill to see like and try to figure out who like which character names were changed.
Well, with names like Ruiz in there, at least they cast diversity in the straight stage show.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, I really tried to find a cast recording, but they haven't put one out yet because it's too new and COVID, obviously.
Yeah.
But I did. There was like a 30-minute preview video that has some of the songs. One of the songs is called "Brantley is a D-bag," which is apparently really hilarious and very apt. So,
So at least they have fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to know who the Lockharts are supposed to be, because they definitely have a lot of them.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'll read some of the reviews. The reviews are, I'm going to say, mostly positive, but I have one from our friend from Katie Sullivan with the Chicago Sun-Times.
Oh, outstanding.
We heard her earlier during the 60-minute synopsis, which...
Oh, I love the callback. Love it.
Which we'll get to. So our first review, these are all Chicago area reviewers. So the first one is Noah Schechter with New City. He said, "You might ask yourself, does the world need a new musical adaptation of a late 1980s comedy featuring a young man from the Midwest making a go of it in the Big Apple? Surprisingly, the creators of this musical answered the question in the affirmative, primarily by crafting multiple strong female leads." So I think that gives you a sense of like what some of the changes.
Yeah.
Because the female, there is really only, well, I guess there's two female leads kind of in the movie. And they're both like not great.
Yeah.
But from what it sounds like, Christy in the musical is a lot more relatable, and there's also more to do with Brantley's mom in the musical. The second one is Chris Jones with the Chicago Tribune. He says, "This new musical has tried to update the story. It is set in the digital present, acknowledges the instability of today's corporate jobs, expunges some of the amoral antics of the source movie, and works harder at creating a sympathetic protagonist." Which, I mean, is exactly what you, like I said before, I hate Brantley, so... But he said, "This movie-turned-musical does not sufficiently make its own case for its freshness or relevance to the moment. It could have used a lot more edge." And finally, Katie Sullivan, Chicago Sun-Times.
Okay, Katie.
Her review: "Paramount has taken the bones of a trash heap movie and phoenixed them into something entertaining and commercially viable. The secret of my success could be the lightning strike new musical that actually has the potential for Broadway."
Wow! Oh! She flipped the script!
She did.
Oh, she loves she it! Did. Oh, wow! Oh.
But I don't know if there's a person who hates the movie more than Katie Sullivan of the Chicago Sun-Times.
Wow, so this is a good musical then.
Yeah, it sounds decent. It was scheduled to run from February 12th to March 29, 2020.
I doubt that happened.
But due to obviously the COVID-19 pandemic, it was forced to close early on March 13th. So,
oh boy.
So yeah, I mean, maybe it'll come back if it ever comes to Edmonton. I will definitely go check it out at the Jubilee.
I will, yeah.
So that's my show and tell for this week.
Nice. So, at work, God is on to Brantley still. Christy is distant with him because of the conversation with Howard, and God spots Brantley, and we get a chase scene, and he's running between floors with God on his tail, and Fred is a bit of a help to Brantley, and I do enjoy the scene of, oh, you've got a lap on him, and all that sort of stuff. But he must have outrun God because he tries to duck into his... See why I wanted to keep it as God in there instead of whatever his name is, Barney. Okay, so he must have outrun God because he tries to duck into his office where Howard is and hanging out waiting for Whitfield. He makes up a lie about being at a funeral to cover the fact that he's wearing a suit. Howard sends Brantley with a package up to his own office, and Fred cautions Brantley that he's in dangerous territory but this is where, like you said, it would have been nice if there was some storyline where Fred is actually trying to figure out what's going on, because this is the only taste of that we get right here.
Yeah.
So in Howard's office, here comes aggressively again. Vera aggressively tries to bone Brantley. Brantley is saying that he's involved with someone now, and she says, "Maybe we should introduce your girl to my husband." Ba-dum-bum. Because Howard walks in on them while Vera is trying to assault Brantley, but thanks to some quick thinking with some terrible lying, they, I guess, cover their tracks, so Howard doesn't know that his wife is having sex with his nephew. But thanks to Vera, Brantley gets invited to the party. So later we get the old bait and switch because Howard wants to see Brantley, and he tells him he knows everything that's going on with him. But it turns out that everything, in quotation marks, is him keeping his nose clean and doing a good job in the mailroom. Howard confesses his affair to Brantley and recruits him to shadow Vera so that he can have no distractions at the party in his pursuits of Christy. So at the party, Vera wants to introduce Brantley to all the powerful executives and to do what he did with her. And he says, I can't do that. No, I mean bowl them over, because when you turn on your charm, you're irresistible. Vera was the reason for Howard's success, we find out. And we get our first tastes of the misunderstanding that we're in for at this party, because many of the people at the party recognize him as Carlton. And he tries to play it off as Carlton and Whitfield being his two middle names. Howard attempts to molest Christy, but she walks away. And then in the bushes, Brantley makes himself known to Christy so that she knows he's there, but he's still not trying to be out in the open about anything. It's been a long stretch without one, so of course we need another montage. This is the Brantley meeting and showing off to important people while the Penrose executives argue about the cuts montage. That's the long title. That's Howard is looking for Christy. Someone says he saw her talking to Whitfield by the pool. And when he gets there, he sees Brantley, but he doesn't see Whitfield. So he tasks Brantley with now keeping Whitfield away from Christy. So now we've got more misunderstandings. Oh, the hijinks that's about to happen. Because it's time for another montage. The oh yeah reprise nighttime sneaking around montage. Oh, a whole bunch of people trying to sneak into other people's rooms, but having to hide when they hear someone else walking around late at night. And all this classic hijinks. So much mistaken identity stuff happening, except for the one executive who ends up with Christy in his room, and he comes at her like a deviant sexual predator in the dark. I'm pretty sure he knows who's in his room, and he's trying to sneak up behind her and grab her. Oh boy. So during this montage, Brantley ends up in Christy's room and finds the stolen file. So now all of a sudden he's pissed. Howard gets the key to Christy's room. So we're about to get this invasion of privacy. She has it locked for a reason, Howard. But Brantley hides in the bed. And he ends up with his uncle trying to force himself on him because he thinks that it's Christy. And the song, Oh Yeah, ends, and everyone gets found out. Brantley, the fact that Brantley is being Carlton, the fact that Howard is sleeping with Christy, the fact that Christy is stealing the notes, everybody fights, and Christy keeps getting called a bimbo. Oh, man, and so she throws a vase at the wall, and Vera says, that was a very expensive vase, you bitch, and Vera leaves to call her lawyers, and Brantley and Christy both get fired.
And Brantley never actually personally admits to Christy what he was doing.
Yeah.
Which is like, again, Brantley Foster is a D-bag. Like,
I want to hear that song now.
I know, me too. But I was watching that scene, like, when I was watching it through the second time, and I just could not believe that he never, like, he's just so, he just thinks he's so in the right.
Yeah.
He just thinks he's done nothing wrong. He legitimately thinks he's done nothing wrong.
Yeah, well, and see, I have this coming up in a minute, but I mean, maybe I could just say it now because it's topical, but yeah, there's the point where, like, he's coming at her for saying, he says, you slept with the boss. Yeah. And she says, you slept with the boss's wife. And he says, she seduced me. And she says, he seduced me. What's the difference? And, like, this is such a valid point, Christy. Like, he's attacking you and calling you a whore, basically. You know, not saying, hey, look, I was scamming the company. Yeah. Like, my bad. I actually did something wrong. But he's coming at her for such personal reasons.
And he's also mad at her for stealing files that, like, he doesn't work for them, really. Like,
you don't actually work there. You work several floors lower. Oh, boy.
Yeah, files that he made based on stolen information.
He's like insider trading or something in a way. Like, he's trying to fix the company from the inside out. But he, I feel like he should have been arrested too. Yeah. Like that's the thing. Like, he got fired, but he should have been arrested too, because he's doing so many illegal things.
In the end, he shouldn't be flying back to Kansas because he should be in prison.
Yeah. The only way he should be flying back to Kansas is on the jailbird from Con Air. So Fred and Gene are helping him pack up his office, and, you know, Gene is all sad because, "I was working for someone from the mailroom, but you were such a great boss. You had great ideas. You were energetic, and you kept taking off your pants." Brantley bumps into Christy as he's leaving, and they argue. And like I said, this is where all just personal shit is brought up. But they quickly make up. In the length of an elevator ride, they're already making out. So we don't see the apologies, but somewhere his douchebaggery went away in a short elevator ride, and he hatches a plan to take over the company and use Fred and Gene to help. I do like Fred's line, though. "Is it something that could get me fired? You betcha. I'm in," right? So there is a meeting here, and we find out that Davenport, who is played by the great Fred Gwynne, who was from the Munsters and My Cousin Vinny, is really trying for a merger. Brantley crashes the meeting, and it turns out Brantley has arranged to buy Davenport out with the aid of some financial backers, and it turns out to be all the people he schmoozed at the party. So he managed to win them over, and he didn't have to have sex with them like he did with Vera. Plus, the majority stockholder for Pemrose is also on board, and that turns out to be, bum, 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 twist, Vera! Vera fires Howard and puts Brantley in charge. I don't know if this is how business works, but I think the board still has to vote on it. I don't think the majority stockholder can just walk into a meeting and say, "You're fired." Like, but,
well, I mean, Bruce Wayne does that in The Dark Knight.
Yeah, in The Dark Knight, that's true. But isn't he also the CEO, though? Or does... No, oh, no, because... Lucius, yeah, Lucius he's put is, Lucius in yeah. charge at that point. Okay. Yeah, going down the rabbit hole of another movie. So Brantley does the only professional thing possible when he gets promoted and starts making out with his girlfriend right there at the desk and tells everyone else that they can go ahead and do that amongst themselves as well. Brantley wants to take Christy home in the company jet, and the prediction is complete. He said the next time he's returning to Kansas, "No round trip ticket for me. I'm coming home in a private jet," and he gets the company jet. Way to go, Brantley! Way to scam the company! And, of course, Vera and Fred make a connection, because, you know, Vera hasn't been spending enough time in the mailroom, but she likes Fred's style. And we get the happy ending, and we are treated to one more montage just before the credits start. And we're in the "We're Fancy Now" montage. God is the limo driver, and people have coupled up. You know, Brantley and Christy are definitely a thing, and Vera and Fred are definitely a thing. And even though they're all fancy and in tuxedos and going to the opera, Brantley still wears sneakers because he's a farmer at heart. The end credits, boom! Secret of my success.
Not the end, because in the credits they play this song, and if you listen to the lyrics, it says, "Sometimes nice guys finish first." Fuck that. There is no nice guys in this movie. Like,
oh boy. Colin, IMDb, it scored 6.5 out of 10. Metascore of 36. I wonder if Katie's review is part of those Metascore reviews. Rotten Tomatoes, it has 57% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 58%. You've got critics for us, don't you?
I do.
Yeah? Let's do it. All right. Give us some critics.
So, I'm going to go... I have two Google user reviews and then the gold standard, as always, Roger Ebert, who I'm going to start with. So, Roger Ebert gave this movie 1.5 stars. He says, "There's nothing really wrong with the premise, but the screenplay could have been a lot more clever. The writers are experts at recycling old script ideas, and here they settle for all of the basic gags they can milk out of a mistaken identity. Like most movies about mistaken identities, this one relies heavily on the idiot plot. Everyone in the movie is an idiot, or the mystery would be solved in 5 minutes.
Yep.
Does the movie really believe anyone is as stupid as these characters? Does it care? And then Google user Chris Camerai gave it 2 out of 5 stars.
Okay.
And he says, an unremarkable watch, not planning on watching again and can't recommend. I just checked out in the third act where all the action was. In 1987, maybe there weren't a lot of movies like this, and someone had the idea to make the kid from Back to the Future work really hard for his next paycheck. But today we have lots of comedic actors that work as hard or harder. Not that Mr. Fox ever did not put his all into his work. For bigger results and better written movies. So not only did I not care about the characters, the chaos, or the result, it's a little bland. It was well produced and performed. I'm just not sure why they did it on this story. Today, watch Wolf of Wall Street instead. It's just a better use of your time. And then Ryan Hall went in another direction. He had 5 out of 5 stars.
Okay.
He says, inspirational film for parents that want to show their children how to take control of their own lives by moving out of the house and jumping into a great career. Standing on your own 2 feet should be the theme in life for everyone. And events don't always go as planned. So...
that's a great one.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, I don't think I have to guess very hard about where you're probably going to fall on this. You gave 10% to UHF. You gave to Monster Squad. I'm assuming it's somewhere between the range of and 10 for you. Or does this actually rank a little bit higher for you?
I would rather watch Monster Squad than watch this movie ever again.
Okay.
This is a movie that I would say deserves to be vaulted. It's very much just of a time. Nothing about it, I think, is relevant anymore. It screams. I was trying to watch this movie and decide if at the time it came out, if it was meant to be some sort of, like, I don't know, commentary on office life or... mm-hmm. self-help stuff of the time, because that's what it feels like now.
I think if you want a movie that is enjoyable where it's someone that's saying fuck you to the man in an office setting, I think you should go see Office Space.
Because that does, and
like you said, you don't know whether it's a commentary, you don't know whether it's something, you know, supposed to be making fun of this life, but at least Office Space, you know that it is.
Yeah. When I was watching this movie the second time around, I kind of felt like... I was trying to think about what this movie would look like if it was made today.
Yeah.
I just felt like it would be... it wouldn't really be made today. It would be like a Silicon Valley type entrepreneurial movie. And mm-hmm. then I was like, but that's Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And that show is actually funny. And this movie... I don't know. The characters, I just did not relate to any of them. I could appreciate... the like whimsical charm of Michael J. Fox, and yeah. I can see why on his virtue alone,
mm-hmm.
people would go want to see this movie just for him.
Yeah,
but when you actually take a look at the character he's playing, it's not great.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where you nailed it. Is that it's the performances,
mm-hmm.
like it's the whimsical charm of Michael J. Fox. And it is the performances that I enjoyed. Some of the lines that a few of the characters have, like Fred Melrose, or you know, like the wacky situations between Gene catching him changing and everything like that. But Michael J. Fox was a great physical comedian.
Yeah.
Like some of the things he's doing, like when he is trying to get out of the pool house when Uncle Howard comes home after he's just fucked his aunt, and he's pulling on clothes, but he's pulling them on backwards because he puts the dress shirt on first and the t-shirt over top, like, and just tripping over couches and everything like that. Michael J. Fox is fun to watch, and some of the things he says, if you like the Michael J. Fox delivery of mm-hmm. lines and everything like that, it's entertaining. Fred Melrose is an entertaining little sidekick. But, like, even saying that the performances are good, most of the performances are good.
Yeah.
You know, I think Christy and Uncle Howard are kind of, why are you guys here? Like, how stupid are you? Or just, like, how inconsistent of a character are you?
I kind of watching it, I think that was the, I agree with the one Chris Camerai. Like, I kind of just felt like Michael J. Fox was above this movie.
Yeah.
Like, it was just like a movie that didn't need to be made.
And all the and it's all montages.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't even keep track of montages, but, like, some of them are, like, mini montages, pseudo montage, maybe not traditional montages, but I think I was up to 7.
Yeah.
I didn't think of numbering them when I was doing my notes, but, like, there's so many montages, and it's kind of like, okay, well, the Footloose guy found out what he was good at.
Yeah.
You know, so instead of Kevin Bacon dancing in a warehouse, we've got Michael J. Fox running around tripping over couches and changing in elevators and stuff. Yeah, my love for Michael J. Fox
carries you through.
Carries me to at least the point of saying I can get behind that Metascore. I'll go 30% on this movie. Which is even lower than the Metascore because it's not a great movie. It passes so fast in montages, and it's such an unlikely concept or unlikely situation. And
well, I was going to ask you because you said you really liked this movie when you're a kid, but is this one of those movies that you would say, like, you would be excited to watch with your kids?
No. Not anymore.
No.
Not anymore. Even with Chris walking in on me. My oldest son, who was our guest on Bill and Ted's, even with him walking in on me and asking the questions about Ferris Bueller's Day Off and everything like that, even with him, I wouldn't have turned around and said, yeah, you got to see this one.
Yeah.
This one's just the bee's knees.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and this one, we don't even have to go into the lack of diversity or anything like that. You know, like all those typical 80s things that usually come up in our movies to say that, no. This is problematic in other ways. He's a criminal!
Yeah.
He's a straight-up criminal. I'll give it 30. That's as high as I'm going.
All right.
Well, that's the secret of my success, and that's our show for this week. If you like that show, oh boy, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is go to Apple or Stitcher or whatever app you listen to your podcasts on and give us 5 stars. It doesn't matter what you say. You can tell us that Brantley is a D-bag, but you have to say D in order to get it past the censorship of Apple. But it's those 5 stars that just drive us up the charts and help us get noticed.
And hey, send us an email. I used to like this one, allonword@gmail.com, or check out our website, www.iusedtolikethisone.com. There you can find links to all our social medias, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. That'll be the best place for you to find what movies we're watching so that you can watch them too and then come hear what we have to say.
And also, if you want to be a producer of the show, if you want to help us out financially, help us get some new equipment, help us build an in-home studio, I don't know, make us sound better, you can do so by going to patreon.com. I guess with that one, don't forget the W's as well. www.patreon.com/IUsedToLikeThisOne. And there you can become a patron of the show. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells. Music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thanks for listening. And join us next week when we take a look at another movie on
I Used to Like This One.